Blog Talk Radio.
I want all privately owned radios to be immediately impounded.
Yeah.
Blog Talk Radio.
Radio Free Kansas.
Well, there is such a place, Trouble.
There must be.
It's not a place you can get to by a boat or a train. Far, far away. Behind the moon. Beyond the rain.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have an announcement.
I can no longer sit back and allow the conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
Let's talk about
creeping like a communist. It's knocking at our doors, voraciously devouring the way things are today. Savagely deflowering the
official story.
Radio Free Kansas.
Madness.
Radio Free Kansas.
Madness.
Why should you put your hands, G.I.?
Now, why don't you just take it easy? Please make me a drink of grain alcohol and rainwater and help yourself to whatever you'd like.
Radio Free Kansas out of North Jefferson County, Kansas.
Kansas.
Ear to the ground, voice in the air worldwide.
Well, that's it, boys. I've been redeemed.
Radio Free Kansas.
Done washed away all my sins and transgressions.
You can listen in.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. President Barack Obama won re-election to a second term last night in a race called surprisingly early. In his acceptance speech in Chicago, the Democrat outlined the challenges for the country and government ahead.
The role of citizen in our democracy does not end with your vote. America's never been about what can be done for us. It's about what can be done by us. Together through the hard and frustrating but necessary work of self-government. That's the principle we were founded on.
With vote count still ongoing in some states, Obama appears to have won both the popular vote and the Electoral College. Democrats were able to flip a couple of Senate seats with wins by Elizabeth Warren in Massachusetts and Joe Donnelly in Indiana. Deb Fischer won the formerly Democratic Nebraska Senate seat for the Republicans. Independent Angus King won retiring GOP Senator Olympia Snowe's seat in Maine. Perhaps the most surprising was a win by North Dakota Democrat Heidi Heitkamp, who was expected to lose and allowed Republicans to pick up the democratically held seat. In Connecticut, despite spending a total of $92 million of her own money in Senate races in 2010 and 2011, candidate Linda McMahon lost yesterday by a wider margin than expected. FSRN's Melinda Tuhus reports.
Despite one of the most expensive and negative campaigns in Connecticut history, Democrat Chris Murphy defeated former WWE wrestling head Linda McMahon by 8 points and will take the place of retiring Senator Joe Lieberman. McMahon undertook a controversial attempt to widen her base in the state's heavily Democratic urban areas. Her campaign paid a large number of African-American campaign workers to promote the idea of splitting the ticket while wearing purple T-shirts proclaiming, "I support Obama and McMahon." Still, she lost heavily in the cities. Murphy raised about $15 million. In his victory speech, he noted that while this wasn't a race dominated by outside super PAC money, McMahon's personal fortune skewed the spending but did not determine the outcome.
We proved that what matters most in life is the measure of your ideas, is the measure of your determination, is the measure of your friends, not the measure of your wallet.
In another close Connecticut race, Democrat Elizabeth Esty beat her Republican opponent to win Murphy's House seat. Melinda Tuhus, FSRN, New Haven.
Republicans are expected to easily hold control of the U.S. House, but Democrats are poised to close the gap at least some. In Texas, Democrat Pete Gallego unseated incumbent Tea Party-backed Republican Kiko Canseco. Democrat Kristen Sinema has won a new district in Arizona, becoming the first bisexual to win a congressional seat. In the race to replace Arizona Democrat Gabrielle Giffords, who was severely injured during a shooting spree at a campaign event, It appears Republican Martha McSally has defeated Giffords' former chief of staff, Ron Barber. As in Colorado, voters in Washington State approved an initiative legalizing marijuana last night. The state also appears to have joined Maryland and Maine in affirming a state law establishing same-sex marriage. The Washington governor's race, however, is still too close to call. State Attorney General Rob McKenna and former U.S. Congressmember Jay Inslee are locked in a virtual tie with many more votes to count. FSRN's Mark Taylor Canfield reports from Seattle.
The election for governor of Washington State is still undecided, with more than 600,000 votes yet to be counted. Republican Rob McKenna and Democrat Jay Inslee, who led as of Wednesday morning, both refused to concede defeat, and election officials say it could be several more days before a winner can be declared. A large portion of mail-in votes from Democratic-leaning King County have not been processed. Supporters of Initiative 502 celebrated when the state voted to legalize the recreational use of marijuana for adults. But some longtime pot advocates in Washington are opposed to the new law. Critics say law enforcement officers will be checking the amount of THC in the blood of drivers suspected to be under the influence, which could result in the prosecution of medical marijuana patients. So far, voters have upheld the state's new same-sex marriage law. With about 70% of ballots counted, Referendum 74 is receiving 52% yes votes. The announcement sparked a large spontaneous celebration on the streets of Seattle that went late into the night. Mark Taylor Canfield, Free Speech Radio News, Seattle.
And finally, voters in Puerto Rico, for the first time ever, said they would support becoming a U.S. state. In a two-part advisory question on the ballot, 54% said they did not approve of the island's current status in relation to the United States, a territory. When asked what kind of relationship they would have instead, 61% said they favored statehood. It's unclear, though, whether the vote will carry weight with the U.S. Congress, which would have to approve any formal statehood bid. And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
On the air, brothers and sisters. Yeah, what do you think of that last night? That came in awfully quick. I was bowled over. By 11 o'clock, I was like, he did it. I can't believe it. Well, I've got a great, at the top of the scroll at the Fighting Cock Flyer, there's a great article by Dave Lindorf at This Can't Be Happening. Very informative. Dave says, time to get organized. So I've been doing that. Talking to my neighbors. A couple of them stopped by today. Wanted to have a little coffee with me in the morning. Their jaws were dropped, too. And I'm happy to report, well, first, let's do the program schedule for tonight. November 7th, 2012. Coming up, Hiram Brown's CBS Radio Mystery Theater. Then at the top of the second hour, Free Speech Radio News, followed by Martin from Australia, Radio Australia, Kaput Radio. Plus, I'll try to throw in some poetry, short stuff from LibriVox, the good volunteers at LibriVox. in the news. Well, the Dow Jones Index dropped 314 points, the largest in over 1 year. Yeah, largest drop in 1 year. As reported by local, oh, by the way, the locals, those are with the coffee I was drinking with. They said that they were going to go out to their contacts throughout North Jefferson County with the election of Obama, gather their reports, gather opinions, find out what bits of wisdom that the older folks around the coffee bars might have to offer. I had a phone call this afternoon. It's been attributed. The only reason that they could figure out that President Barack Hussein Obama was reelected was because of the Mayan calendar. Yes, those dirty, extinct, indigenous Native Americans, the Mayans, and their calendar caused the re-election of President Barack Obama. Of course, it has been reported that the Latino voters did come out 71% for Obama. Also today, I was monitoring Rush Limbaugh, always interested in seeing what the right wing says when they get kicked in the balls. He attributed President Obama, well, he said he couldn't. He's not responsible. Rush is not responsible because he can't overthrow, quote, Santa Claus. Limbaugh went on to describe Obama's supporters, the supporters of President Obama, as, I got my Obama phone. I got my Obama care. I got my food stamps. I got my flat screen TV. I got my extended unemployment check. What more do I need? According to Rush Limbaugh on November 7th. Other GOP watchers are attributing Mitt's defeat. Hold on here. There you go. They're attributing Mitt Romney's defeat to the, quote, front-end spending, unquote, before the primaries. These same critics, GOP watchers, claim that it was all that whack-a-mole, the whack-a-mole that Mitt had to play, Mr. Romney, on the heads of the GOP candidates. Well, the Senate also had elections. Not that you know it. But now there's 53 Dems, Democrats, 45 Republicans, and 2 Independents. And the most recent addition is Elizabeth Warren and Senator incumbent Claire McCaskill. And out of Wisconsin, Tammy Baldwin, the first gay senator, female, serve in the House of Representatives. 10 GOP candidates lost, bringing the tally to 235 Republicans, who lost 5, and the Democrats, who gained 5 to come to a grand total of 200. And of course, the big news tonight, pot is legal in Colorado and Washington State. Isn't that great?
Yes, Radio Mystery Theater presents... Come in. Welcome. I'm E.G. Marshall. And after all, what is a lie? 'Tis but the truth in masquerade, according to Lord Byron. Does it work both ways? Is the truth a lie in masquerade? Those great poets are not always easy to follow. Is it possible that there are neither absolute lies nor absolute truths, but varying degrees of each? As we shall discover, perhaps, during the next hour.
I want you to tell me everything you know about the murder.
Well, what murder is that, Lieutenant?
The murder that took place on your train this morning.
Oh, now, wait a minute. That wasn't a murder. A fella died of a heart attack.
Yeah? Who told you it was a heart attack?
Well, I mean, the way he just keeled over, I kind of thought...
No. He was murdered.
Our mystery drama, Come Fill My Cup, was written especially for the Mystery Theater by Sam Dan and stars Larry Haynes and William Griffiths. I'll be back shortly with Act One. Out of the shadows of the night, the world rolls into light. It is daybreak everywhere, sings the poet.
Yes,
daybreak and breakfast and off to the daily round of toil for one's bread. They gather at the railroad station in the town of Westville to catch the 7:49, which will bear them to the big city, more than 50 miles and 61 minutes away. And they purchase their big city newspapers. They stamp their feet against the cold. They exchange idle small talk till the big, shiny electric cars skitter to a stop along the platform, and they scatter aboard and scramble for seats. Thus, another day has begun.
Aboard! Aboard!
My name is Frank Dorham. I've been with the road 45 years. I can remember steam, diesels, now these. 45 years. Rain, shine, snow, hail. What do them letter carriers say? Well, we go through the same thing. It's funny. When people find out I'm conductor of the 749, they kind of look at me and say, hey, isn't that the one? Yeah. It's the one where the guy was murdered. Now, as a rule, people don't get murdered on trains. Why, I knew all about the Orient Express, but a commuter train? So I guess you want to know all about it. Okay? Tickets? I'll take it, please. Oh, say, what are you doing up here, Mr. Jorgensen?
Morning, Frank.
Yeah, I thought you'd be back in the club car with Jerry and them.
Yeah, I decided to change my ways. No more cards.
Is that a fact?
You better believe it.
Well, I hope for your sake it's true.
No, Frank, it's all over. I don't need a sermon.
I always felt that poker game was too rich for your blood.
You've no idea how anemic it made me.
If you'll pardon my saying it, you were in way over your head. Jerry Garlick, at least a millionaire, so's Pete McHugh. As for Bill...
I'm well out of it.
Well, you listen to a man who's old enough to be your father. You see, you stay out of it. That made me feel good. Don Jorgensen had been a patsy in his high-stakes poker game for more than a year. In 61 minutes, Westville to New York, you could lose $100, $150 easy. And there were days Don did just that. Well, I went back to punch tickets in the club car. That's the last car in the 749's, private car you pay extra for it, but you can sit at a table, have coffee or breakfast, play cards, and you're away from the, well, not the riffraff, but how the fella put it, the maddening throng or something. Tickets, gentlemen. Thank you.
Frank, you seen Don?
Hmm?
I saw him on the platform getting on a train. He's holding up the game. Look, you fellas sit here, play hand a gin or something. I'll rout him out.
Jerry got up from the table and started walking forward. I wondered what luck he would have with Don. When I went up ahead again, I saw him sitting next to Don. I moved slowly and stood behind him. I was curious.
Everybody's luck turns, kid.
Except mine.
Now, look, you enjoy the game.
I can't afford it
anymore.
Now,
that's an argument I can't buck.
But I am reformed from now on.
Okay, kid. I hope so.
I got a book to read, a crossword puzzle.
Look, I'm all for a guy kicking a habit, any habit. It's just...
It's just what?
Well, it's just... I wish you didn't decide to kick it today.
Why not today?
Well, I feel lucky.
Then I'm definitely picking the right time.
I feel today is my day to take Peter McHugh.
So, go take him.
Nobody wants to play three-handed.
Well, you can pick up somebody else.
No, there's not many guys with the courage to play in that game.
Not to mention the money.
Listen, Don, do me a favor. Quit tomorrow.
Tomorrow?
Yeah, play today.
No.
Come on now, it's a favor to me.
It sure wouldn't be a favor to me.
Don, you can't lose.
Would you like to know how much I lost this past year?
What I'm trying to say.
And to you, Jerry.
It won't cost you a cent to play today, Don.
Oh, yeah? Let's hear this.
If you win, you win. Keep it. But if you lose, I'll pay you back.
What?
No matter how much. Just keep tabs, and I'll pay you back every cent later.
Well, you must really want to play bad.
Come on, Don. I can hit Pete for a bundle. How can you lose?
Okay. Just this once.
I didn't know what to make of that whole conversation. Anyhow, Jerry and Don got up, walked to the club car. I finished up front and went back there myself for the morning coffee. Down toward the end of the car, I could see the poker game in full swing. I stood at the bar while Lou handed me my usual coffee and I ate, drank slowly. I turned to watch the poker players. I could hear the conversation, clinking of coins, and I could see the green of the bills.
Pair of deuces is high. It's you, Jerry.
Yeah. So I see. Well, pair of deuces check.
Deuces check. Dealer folds. So, ace high bets, that's you, Pete.
This ace high bets $10.
Bill, I see you fold. Okay, that leaves it up to deuces, Jerry.
Yeah, so it does. Well, the little deuces will see that $10 bet and raise you 20.
And that's about how it would go. Check and raise, which is about as cutthroat as poker can ever get. But at least they were honest about it. They didn't pretend it was a friendly game. It went on like that for a bit. And then...
Who wants a cup of coffee? You, Pete?
I had enough.
Bill, you still off coffee? Come on, fellas, I'm buying. How about you, Don?
When'd you ever know me to turn down a cup of coffee?
Yeah, I'll go up and get it now while I'm out of this hand. I'll be right back.
Got your card game going, Mr. Garland?
Yep. We have to find a new recruit. Lou, a cup of coffee for me and Mr. Jorgensen. Come on, I'm losing money standing here.
Well, sure thing, Mr. Garland.
Just then, I thought I heard a kind of squealing sound. I left my coffee and walked back quickly to the rear cab. I opened the door to see if maybe we didn't have a jam brake. But it was nothing. Anyhow, I stood there for a couple of seconds. I could see Lou at the bar up ahead pouring the two cups of coffee. He put them on the tray, and Jerry spilled a packet of sugar into each. Now, the reason I go into all these details is because this is that famous, or what I should say, notorious day. Well, I started back for the bar. Jerry picked up the tray and started toward the table. Halfway, we met in the aisle. I was about to step aside to let him pass when we hit that curve just before we crossed the New York state line. Now, the train sways pretty bad, and I could see Jerry was about to lose his balance. Well, I wanted to help him, but as he fell back, he automatically thrust the tray forward, and I caught it and took it from his hands. He grabbed the back of his seat, and so did I. For a few seconds, we both nearly fell, but we both managed to keep our balance. Then Jerry took the tray back from me and went to his table, and I watched the game continue from the bar.
Here's your coffee, Don.
Thanks. Five-card draw, Jerry. We dealt you in. Ante up $5.
Little Jack's the better, huh?
The famous name of the game.
Well, let's take a sip of this coffee, and I'll examine my options.
Hey, let's get a move on, huh? We'll be in the terminal in less than 15 minutes.
Come on. There's enough time for entire fortunes to be made, Pete.
Boy, that's pretty good coffee this morning, Jerry.
Yeah. Lou gets lucky once in a while. Speaking of luck, gents, she's open for another $5.
Bill, I see you fold.
Call.
I'm in, and now, cards.
Hey, that is pretty good coffee.
Hey, I want three.
Three to Brother Pete?
Yeah. Give me two.
Two to Jerry. And the dealer draws one.
You know, more kids have lost out on a college education because their fathers drew to an inside straight.
Opener bets. That's you, Jerry. Jerry?
Jerry, you gonna sit there and drink that coffee or what?
All right, don't rush. Don't rush me.
Don't rush our good friend.
Let's see. Don, you drew three, huh?
No. Pete drew three.
You bought.
No, I drew one.
One. Bill asked for...
Bill didn't ask for anything. Bill's out.
Oh. Bill is out. You know, it's hot in here. Somebody... I ought to ask Frank to turn down the heat.
Hey, you're going to bet or not?
What do you think I play this? Play this game for? I wish it wasn't so hot here.
Hey, Jerry, you okay?
Yeah, it's my bet, huh?
Hey, Pete, Bill, I think there's something wrong with Jerry.
I bet,
Frank, come over here, quick.
Oh, my chest. My chest.
Frank. Frank, you got a phone on this train? Call ahead for an ambulance.
I got this.
Jerry!
I telephoned to have an ambulance meet us at the next station. There was also a doctor among the passengers in the third car, and he came back quickly. But it didn't matter. Nothing would matter anymore to Jerry Garland. He was dead. They took him off the train. When we got to the terminal, I had a lot of writing to do, a lot of forms to fill out and reports to make. I was busy in the locker room when I heard a man ask for me.
You Frank Durham?
Yeah, that's right.
I'm Lieutenant Parsons, New York City Police.
Yeah?
You're the conductor of train number 4231. It's the 749 out of Westville, Connecticut.
Sure. Hmm.
I want you to tell me everything you know about the murder.
What murder is that?
The murder that took place on your train this morning.
Well, wait a minute. That wasn't a murder. A fella died.
A man by the name of Gerald K. Garland.
Yes, he died of a heart attack.
Oh, yeah? Who told you it was a heart attack?
Well, I mean, the way he keeled over, I kind of thought that...
No. He was murdered.
How could he have been murdered?
He was poisoned.
How could he have been poisoned?
That's just what I want to ask you.
Okay, let's all ask ourselves, how could he have been poisoned? And to get the red tape out of the way, the facts are clear. Lieutenant Parsons made that statement because a medical examination showed definite traces of staronine, a poison in the strychnine family. So, we have our murder on the 749. But how? Look, this is only the end of Act One. You'll have to be patient until I return with Act Two. Trust everybody, but cut the cards, said the beloved Mr. Dooley. Ah, yes. How many decks of cards have been cut and shuffled on the 749, the commuter express from Westville, especially in the club car, where perhaps the most cutthroat game has been going on for several years? Well, if a game keeps being cutthroat, someone may begin to take that word literally. Obviously, someone did, except he didn't use a knife. He employed poison.
Poison? Are you saying Jerry Garland was poisoned, Lieutenant?
Well, that's what the medical examiner says, and it's good enough for me.
But poison? How could he have been poisoned?
Well, as they say, it was ingested in the coffee he drank.
Oh, no, no.
Yes, happens to be the fact. Now, it took place in the club car. And what was Jerry Garland doing at the time of his death?
He was playing cards. He was part of this regular game. He was playing and drinking his coffee. And then he just keeled over.
And the coffee? How did he get the coffee?
He went up the bar for two coffees.
Two coffees?
Yeah, one for himself and the other for Don Jorgensen. Well, he picked up the coffee.
Who served the coffee?
Lou. Lou Vitry, our barman.
Now, Lou poured out the coffee into the cups.
Yeah, that's right. Then Jerry put them on a tray and went back to the table.
Now, would you know if there was cream and sugar in the coffees?
Yeah, now you mention it. I saw Jerry put in the cream and sugar himself while he was still at the bar.
Into both coffees?
Yeah, that's right.
And then he went back to the table. And then what did he do?
He gave one cup to Don Jorgensen. One cup he kept for himself.
Yeah.
Well, couldn't have been more than a couple, 3 minutes, and that was it.
And he drank this coffee?
Oh, yeah.
The other cup of coffee, the one he gave us...
Don Jorgensen.
Yeah, Don Jorgensen. He drank his coffee also?
Yeah.
You saw him do it?
Oh, yes.
Right. I want you to stay with me while I question some of the people in that club car.
When?
As soon as I can round them up.
Well, I have to take 1127 out.
No. I don't think so.
That was Detective Lieutenant Parsons. Grover Cleveland Parsons. Well, the first person he got hold of was Lou Vitry, the barman. All of a sudden, I got the shock of my life. But I'll feed it to you gently, the way it was fed to me.
How long have you been with the railroad?
5 years, Lieutenant.
What'd you do before that?
Look, Lieutenant, is it important?
I just answered the question.
I work for Mr. Garland.
Jerry Garland?
Yeah.
As what?
Well, I was his chauffeur.
Well, why did you leave the job?
Look, do I have to say this?
Answer the question.
Well, can the answer be confidential between me and the cops?
Well, so far.
Because if it's known, I can lose my job. Does Frank have to hear me answer?
No, he won't say anything. I guarantee it. Well, why could you lose your job?
Because I got a record.
For what?
I did 3 years for burglary, but I was innocent.
Tell it, Lou.
Well... One night, there was a burglary. Jewels that belonged to Jerry's wife, Theodora, were stolen. Well, they searched all the servants, naturally, and in my room, I found a bracelet.
Well, what was it doing there?
Well, it must have been planted there by the thieves to turn the heat on me. And it did. I was put away.
Well, how did you get the job on the railroad if you had this record?
Jerry Garland got it for me.
Why?
Well, when I got out... I went to him to his office.
Well, what are you doing here, Lou? You escaped from jail?
No, I'm out, Mr. Garland.
What do you want?
Well, I didn't steal those jewels.
Now, look, Lou, it was all decided by a court of law.
I ain't a crook, and you know it.
Well, maybe not, but you might have been tempted.
No, never. I've been your chauffeur 13 years. You trusted your kids to me when I was little. I lived in your house. Now, you know I ain't a crook. Mr. Garland, you gotta help me.
Well, Lou, if you need some money to get on your feet...
No, I need more than money. I need a job. I can't get a job. I got a record. You understand?
Yeah, I know. I know it's tough, Lou.
You don't know how tough it is. I'm turned down everywhere I go. Look, help me get a job. Give me a job.
No. Can't very well take you back as my chauffeur.
Why not?
Well, how would it look?
Well, can't you do anything for me? I'll take any job at all. He got me a job. This job. My name isn't Lou Vitry either. I had to change it. Vitry's my mother's maiden name.
Well, how could the poison have gotten into Mr. Garland's cut?
I don't know.
Okay, Lou. That's all for now. Just keep handy in case you need it. You can go.
Oh, thanks. Thanks, Lieutenant.
Well, he doesn't have a motive.
He doesn't have a motive. But that's not true, Lieutenant. He does have a motive. And now I know what that motive is. He was the chauffeur. I never knew that. So now it all makes sense, that conversation I overheard in the bar in the club car a couple of weeks ago. The train was crowded. Jerry had gotten up from the card table and come over to pick up a couple of rounds of drinks. Standing at the bar was Mr. Alexander Trowbridge. Yeah, the very big guy on Wall Street. Very strict, very dignified. Anyhow, Jerry spotted him and said,
"Hello there, Alex.
Good evening, Mr. Garland."
"Well, it ain't every day I have the privilege of riding home on a train with the Wolf of Wall Street. Hey, let me buy you a drink."
"Thank you, I have one."
"Well, have another one, on me."
"That won't be necessary, thank you. I never have more than one."
"Okay, Alex. So look, I may drop over to your office one day. I may have a little business to throw your way."
Jerry Garland had a hide like a rhinoceros, which is why you couldn't kill him with a bullet or a knife. You had to use poison. Anyhow, it was obvious to me that Mr. Trowbridge was very put out. And the fellow standing next to him spotted it, too. And I remember Trowbridge saying,
"I have every reason to suspect that man is a thief. There's no real proof, of course, but Swanson's company handles the man's insurance. He had a burglary some years ago. Wife's jewels were supposed to be stolen. Swanson could swear Garland pulled a swindle on the insurance company."
"Is that so?"
"The jewels never turned up at any of the known receivers of stolen goods. Actually, Swanson must know more than he's telling, but he's stuck for proof. Another round here, please, Lou."
"Yes, sir."
"I know Swanson wouldn't make such a charge, even off the record, unless he knew it was true. Meanwhile, some poor servant went to jail at..."
"I'm sorry, sir."
"Oh, that's all right, Lou.
It spilled all over you."
"Well, it's just water. No harm done."
Was that why Lou dropped the glass? Was that why he turned so pale? I didn't think anything about it at the time. But now it makes sense. The lieutenant had just said that Lou Vitry did not have a motive, but he did have.
Yeah, Frank. I know about it.
About Lou having a motive?
Yep. He told me himself. He figured if this kind of thing was being talked about, how Jerry Garland himself could have staged the robbery, it was sure to get the cops, and then he'd really be in a jam.
Well, he's in a jam anyhow, isn't he?
Well, not exactly. You see, if he poisoned the coffee and then gave two cups to Jerry to take back to the table, how could he be sure which cup Jerry would drink?
Yeah.
Frank, you see these fellas every day. Who had a motive for killing Jerry?
Well, nobody really liked him.
Well, who were his friends?
In the club car?
Mm-hmm.
Well, he had no friends I knew of. Nobody really liked him.
Well, who might have liked him the least?
Now, you get into a discussion of human nature, Lieutenant.
Bill Russell, one of the regulars in the game, never opened his mouth except to bet. Now, how do I know what that man thought? Don Jorgensen. Well, he didn't like Jerry. Over the year, he must have lost at least $15,000 in that game. Jerry was practically the only big winner.
$15,000 could be a motive for revenge.
No, but take Pete McHugh. Now, he fancies himself the best poker player in the world. Yet Jerry was always taking his money.
A lot of money?
No. The biggest loss was pride. Is that a motive?
No, not really. Don Jorgensen. Tell me more about him.
Funny thing. This morning he decided to quit the game. But he went back for kind of a farewell.
Let's see what we can do with Don Jorgensen. You lost heavily.
Well, I wouldn't say so, Lieutenant.
Now, it is common knowledge aboard the 749 that you were an unusually big loser. Now, is that true?
Well, actually, in a friendly game, you don't notice.
Now, look, we've got a murder case. You'd better tell me the truth. Now, we know you work for Simmons and Boswell in Wall Street. And we know what your salary is. We know just about how much you've been losing.
Now, hold on, Lieutenant.
Shall we check your bank to see what loans you negotiated and your insurance company to see if any policies were cashed in? Of course, if you borrowed from the loan sharks, you will really need our help.
Okay. It's true. You want to know what I lost? $21,364.87. You see? I know it to the penny. How could it happen? Well, you take the train an average of 200 days a year. You lose an average of $100 a day. Well, not every day. Sometimes you win. I even won $300 one morning, but that's just the cheese and the trap. Don't ask me why I kept doing it. It's a bad dream. It cost me my wife. She's going to divorce me.
You suspected Jerry was cheating.
Yes.
Did you kill him?
No.
I think you did.
Lieutenant, I swear to you, I'm innocent.
And I think I know how you worked it. The only way you could have worked it.
That's pretty good. If Don Jorgensen wanted to have Jerry Garland drink a cup of poisoned coffee, how could Don have worked it? Since, as we saw, Jerry got the two cups of coffee. Jerry handed out the coffee. How could Don be sure he wasn't getting the wrong one? Well, Lieutenant Parsons has made his deduction on facts and inferences that were available to all of you. Why don't we compare notes in Act 3 in just a few moments? This one... Mr. Sam Johnson, whom we quote quite often because he knew practically everything worth knowing, declared that a man could do anything if he did it in a genteel way, even cheat at cards. Well, Sam Johnson never rode in a commuter train. Jerry Garland cheated, and in the opinion of the police, that's why someone, namely Don Jorgensen, murdered him.
But I didn't do it.
You don't have to say anything.
Am I being arrested, Lieutenant?
Mr. Jorgensen, because of Jerry Garland, you lost your wife. All the money you had.
No. I lost everything because of my own weakness.
And so you decided to kill him.
You're wrong.
You worked out this scheme to poison him.
What good would it do for me to kill him? Would it burn out the disease I have inside of me, this mania to gamble? I swore I would quit, but I can't.
You figured you would poison his coffee.
How? Frank, you saw. The whole club car saw. Jerry went to the bar. He got the coffee. If there was poison in one cup, I could have gotten it.
No. You had a way to guard against that.
How? How could I guard against that?
With the help of Lou Vitry.
Lou Vitry?
Don Jorgensen. Lou Vitry. Two men with powerful motives to kill Jerry Garland.
But I tell you, I...
First, wait to hear what I tell you. You knew Jerry liked to treat everybody to coffee, so he could brag about it. You knew he would go to the bar to get it. And you also knew the other two at the table, Pete and Bill, never drank coffee. So you knew it would only be two cups.
I knew nothing of the sort.
Jerry would go up to get the coffee. Lou would pour him the poison cup.
Yeah, but how could Lou make sure I wouldn't drink it?
Because Lou would know which cup was which. And if Jerry set the poison one down next to you, he would give you the high sign. And you would make an excuse or forget to drink it.
It isn't true. Well,
Lieutenant, could I talk to you in private for a second? It couldn't have worked that way.
No?
No.
Well, makes sense. Now, I got two guys with a motive.
Even if you could prove that Don knew about Lou's motive, you don't have a case.
Why not?
Because I saw Lou pour that coffee. It was from the same glass pot that he poured about 10 other cups, including mine. That was the only coffee.
You drank that same coffee?
So did Don and eight other people in the car.
Well, then it was in the cream.
Oh, we all use the same cream pitcher.
The sugar. Now, the sugar was in separate packets.
Yes, it was. They were piled in a dish, and I saw Jerry reach in, pick out two, pour one in each cup. Everybody used those packets from that dish. There was no way either Lou or Don could control any single packet if it contained the poison.
Are you sure of that?
Yeah, I'm sure.
Well, how did that poison get into that coffee? Now, I've got two great motives, Lou and Don. But there's no way I can find for any of them to get the poison in his cup.
Time went on, days passed, and I guess life went on also. I don't know what happens to a murder case when it doesn't get solved and the papers stop writing about it. I suppose it just sort of gets into a file cabinet somewhere. Well, 749 left Westville as usual on or about on time. The club car found other things to talk about. The card game continued with Don back in, but the new member was Mr. Trowbridge. And because he was so fabulously rich, they played for pennies. But I kept thinking and thinking about the murder. Well, one night I was taking my evening run home, and I stopped in the club car. Tickets, please. Tickets.
Hello, Frank.
Oh, evening, Mr. Jorgensen.
Frank, I never did get a chance to thank you properly for what you did for me.
What did I do for you?
Well, the day Jerry was, you know, that cop, he was all set to lower the boom, and you just took him aside. What'd you tell him?
Well, I just said a fine, clean-cut chap like you, how could you possibly be a killer?
I bet you did.
You'd be better off if you never bet again in your life. See you. Tickets, please. Tickets. Thank you. Oh, good evening, Mr. Trowbridge.
Evening, Frank.
No poker tonight?
Well, if I may rephrase the title of a grand old song, those wedding bells are breaking up that old game of mine.
Oh, who's getting married?
At the bar there. Don.
Didn't he just get divorced?
Well, certainly he had to shed the old one before he could acquire a new one. You're not allowed to have two at a time in our culture.
Well, one was all I could ever handle.
Your capacities differ, Frank. Oh, there she is now. She's just come up to the bar. Do you wonder that he finds her company more exciting than our poker game?
No, but don't wonder at all. There is a beautiful young lady.
You mean you don't know who she is, Frank?
Can't say that I do.
She's Dora. Theodora Garland, Jerry's widow.
She's Jerry's widow?
You mean you never met her?
No. Well, for that matter, Mr. Trowbridge, you never met your wife either.
Yes, that's true.
She's Dora Garland. How could you figure to be this young and this pretty?
And how could you ever figure what she saw in Jerry?
I moved back toward the bar. Suddenly, I realized that I had seen her before. Somewhere before. But where? Where? And then I remembered where. At the bar in the terminal. I owed Tom Franklin a run, and I was waiting to take the 1008 out. I was having a beer. There was a man, and there was a woman sitting in the booth ahead of me. The man had his back to me. I couldn't see his face, but I knew it was Don Jorgensen. The woman was facing me. She was that woman. Now I know who she was. Dora Garland. And she and Don Jorgensen were having, as they say, an affair. And from what I knew of Jerry, he was the type who would kill both of them if he found out. So to the long list of motives for murder, add one more. But a good, strong one.
Now, Frank, don't give me any more suspects, huh? I don't want no more motives. I got all of those I can handle. I'll tell you what I need. I need what I can't get. The way any one of them or two of them could have put that poison into the coffee. Why don't you forget it?
Well, it happened on my train. I feel responsible.
Yeah, well, maybe you did it, huh?
Me?
Yeah, well, as I put together everybody's story, Frank, I think you left something out.
What?
You could have poisoned that coffee.
Why? How?
Why, I can dig around for.
How?
Okay. Jerry was starting back to the table with the coffee tray. Okay. Now, you're headed the other way, up the aisle. The train gives a lurch. Jerry almost falls. You grab the tray from him.
For just a second.
Long enough, maybe, to put that poison in the cup.
Yeah? Well, here's what's wrong with that theory. First, how could I have, in those few seconds, gotten the tops off the cups and put in the poison?
Tops?
Well, Lou always puts those plastic tops on the cups so you won't spill any.
Yeah.
Second, even if I was a magician and could do it, how could I be sure which cup Jerry himself drank?
Yeah, that was a good theory.
Well, maybe the coffee wasn't poisoned in the club car.
It had to be. That poison works within minutes. No, I am afraid we're stuck.
It sure looked that way. A couple days passed, and I was on the 749 again, and somehow it didn't seem the same without Jerry. A likable guy he wasn't, but he sure livened things up. And there was another side to him. I remembered it was a couple days before he died. He was the first one on the train. He was sitting at the table waiting for the others. And there was a look on his face that I'd never seen before. I guess it was a lost look. Good morning, Mr. Garland.
Oh, morning, Frank.
Oh, something wrong this morning, Mr. Garland?
Wrong? Why do you say that?
Well, I don't know. I guess you just look kind of, blue.
Do I?
Yeah, I'd say so.
I'd like to murder a couple of people, but that couldn't be the reason.
Well, we'll get the old game started. That puts a bloom in the cheeks.
Now I remembered. That was the morning after I had seen his wife Dora in the bar at the terminal. So he had found out. And he was actually thinking of murder. I just needed one more little fact. Morning, Mr. Jorgensen. See you not in the club car this trip.
No, Mr. Trowbridge is on vacation and Pete is sick today, so I thought I'd sit up here and catch up on some paperwork. Too noisy back there.
Don, when did Mr. Garland find out you were having an affair with his wife?
Say, what are you...
Just answer the question.
Well, not just a... about a week before he died.
How did you know that he knew? Did he tell you?
No.
Did he tell Dora?
No.
And how'd you know?
Frank, did you ever have an affair with another man's wife?
Nope.
You're not missing anything. But when the husband finds out, you can tell. You can tell by certain little things in his manner.
Is that why you and Dora decided to kill him?
No. Oh, no. No, we were scared, yes, but for our own lives. Now, you knew Jerry. He was a was a violent man.
So why did you fool around with his wife?
You know why? To get back at him. He destroyed me. He stripped me of all my money. My wife walked out on me with the kids. I had to get back at him. And this was the only way I could. It was the one place I could prove I was a better man than he was.
And then I saw it. I saw the whole thing. Why did we all wonder who wanted to kill Jerry? Why didn't we ask who it was that Jerry himself wanted to kill? Why did we believe that the poison was intended for Jerry? Why couldn't it be meant for Don Jorgensen?
Now what, Frank?
Lieutenant, you said I could have been responsible for Jerry's death. You were right. I was.
Are you crazy?
Jerry decides to kill Don. Okay. He goes for the coffee. Lou pours. Jerry then opens the sugar packet. Jerry is in a position to use the packet that he had with him that contains the poison. Ah, I notice you're listening now.
Hey, go on.
Now, Jerry comes back to the table with the tray. He knows which cup he has poisoned. But the train gives a lurch. He almost falls. He's about to drop the tray. I'm there. I grab it from him. He saves himself from falling, and his eye is off me for a second or two. I have to stop myself from falling. I switch the tray from my right hand to my left. Unconsciously, I turn it around. He can't see that. It all happens so quickly. I give him the tray as if nothing happened. He gets to drink the poison coffee.
And how do we prove it?
I guess we don't. But I believe it. Do you?
The lieutenant didn't commit himself. Do you believe it? It makes sense. Satisfies all the conditions. But we are dealing with the most unpredictable materials in nature, namely human beings. Maybe Pete McHugh, the jealous card player, did it somehow. Maybe it was Lou, and or Don, and or Dora. Could we swear on our souls it wasn't the conductor? I'll be back with more from the realm of infinite possibility. Our story was about cards. What did a great master of cards say on the subject? The bizarre world of cards, a world of power politics, where punishment and rewards were meted out immediately. A deck of cards is built like the purest of hierarchies, with every card a master to those below it, a lackey to those above it. And there were the masses, the long suits, which always asserted themselves in the end and triumphed over the aces and the kings. Thus spoke the great player, Eli Culbertson, and he was in the know. Our cast included William Griffiths, Larry Haynes, Russell Horton, and Earl Hammond. The entire production was under the direction of Hyman Brown.
G. Marshall inviting you to return to our Mystery Theater for another adventure in the macabre. Until next time, pleasant dreams.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, November 7th, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, Barack Obama wins a second term in office, defeating Mitt Romney. We'll go to Chicago, where supporters weigh in on a second Obama term, and to Massachusetts, where Romney conceded the race and Elizabeth Warren celebrated her U.S. Senate victory. We'll also look at the top issues and results across the U.S., including marriage equality measures, the DREAM Act, and the legalization of marijuana. Those stories and more coming up after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. President Barack Obama won re-election to a second term last night in a race called surprisingly early. In his acceptance speech in Chicago, the Democrat outlined the challenges for the country and government ahead.
The role of citizen in our democracy does not end with your vote. America's never been about what can be done for us. It's about what can be done by us together through the hard and frustrating but necessary work of self-government. That's the principle we were founded on.
With vote counts still ongoing in some states, Obama appears to have won both the popular vote and the Electoral College. Democrats were able to flip a couple of Senate seats with wins by Elizabeth Warren in Massachusetts and Joe Donnelly in Indiana. Deb Fischer won the formerly Democratic Nebraska Senate seat for the Republicans. Independent Angus King won retiring GOP Senator Olympia Snowe's seat in Maine. Perhaps the most surprising was a win by North Dakota Democrat Heidi Heitkamp, who was expected to lose and allowed Republicans to pick up the democratically held seat. In Connecticut, despite spending a total of $92 million of her own money in Senate races in 2010 and 2011, candidate Linda McMahon lost yesterday by a wider margin than expected. FSRN's Melinda Tuhus reports.
Despite one of the most expensive and negative campaigns in Connecticut history, Democrat Chris Murphy defeated former WWE wrestling head Linda McMahon by 8 points and will take the place of retiring Senator Joe Lieberman. McMahon undertook a controversial attempt to widen her base in the state's heavily Democratic urban areas. Her campaign paid a large number of African-American campaign workers to promote the idea of splitting the ticket while wearing purple T-shirts proclaiming, "I support Obama and McMahon." Still, she lost heavily in the cities. Murphy raised about $15 million. In his victory speech, he noted that while this wasn't a race dominated by outside super PAC money, McMahon's personal fortune skewed the spending, but did not determine the outcome.
We proved that what matters most in life is the measure of your ideas, is the measure of your determination, is the measure of your friends, not the measure of your wallet.
In another close Connecticut race, Democrat Elizabeth Esty beat her Republican opponent to win Murphy's House seat. Melinda Tuhus, FSRN, New Haven.
Republicans are expected to easily hold control of the U.S. House, but Democrats are poised to close the gap at least some. In Texas, Democrat Pete Gallego unseated incumbent Tea Party-backed Republican Kiko Canseco. Democrat Kristen Sinema has won a new district in Arizona, becoming the first bisexual to win a congressional seat. In the race to replace Arizona Democrat Gabrielle Giffords, who was severely injured during a shooting spree at a campaign event, it appears Republican Martha McSally has defeated Giffords' former chief of staff, Ron Barber. As in Colorado, voters in Washington State approved an initiative legalizing marijuana last night. The state also appears to have joined Maryland and Maine in affirming a state law establishing same-sex marriage. The Washington governor's race, however, is still too close to call. State Attorney General Rob McKenna and former U.S. Congressmember Jay Inslee are locked in a virtual tie with many more votes to count. FSRN's Mark Taylor Canfield reports from Seattle.
The election for governor of Washington State is still undecided, with more than 600,000 votes yet to be counted. Republican Rob McKenna and Democrat Jay Inslee, who led as of Wednesday morning, both refused to concede defeat, and election officials say it could be several more days before a winner can be declared. A large portion of mail-in votes from Democratic-leaning King County have not been processed. Supporters of Initiative 502 celebrated when the state voted to legalize the recreational use of marijuana for adults. But some longtime pot advocates in Washington are opposed to the new law. Critics say law enforcement officers will be checking the amount of THC in the blood of drivers suspected to be under the influence, which could result in the prosecution of medical marijuana patients. So far, voters have upheld the state's new same-sex marriage law. With about 70% of ballots counted, Referendum 74 is receiving 52% yes votes. The announcement sparked a large spontaneous celebration on the streets of Seattle that went late into the night. Mark Taylor Canfield, Free Speech Radio News, Seattle.
And finally, voters in Puerto Rico, for the first time ever, said they would support becoming a U.S. state. In a two-part advisory question on the ballot, 54% said they did not approve of the island's current status in relation to the United States, a territory. When asked what kind of relationship they would have instead, 61% said they favored statehood. It's unclear, though, whether the vote will carry weight with the U.S. Congress, which would have to approve any formal statehood bid. And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. Narrow wins in nearly every major swing state carried President Barack Obama to victory late Tuesday night to secure a second term as President of the United States. He swept Ohio, Virginia, Wisconsin, Iowa, and Colorado. Florida gave Obama the narrowest lead of about 48,000 votes, according to the Secretary of State's office Wednesday afternoon. Inside Chicago's Lakefront Convention Center, thousands of supporters danced, cheered, cried, and chanted as the results came in. But many acknowledged the difficult road ahead for the president and the deeply divided Congress and vowed to keep pushing for progress on immigration reform, marriage equality, and the social safety net. From Chicago, FSRN's Alice Olstein brings us this report.
Around 2 in the morning on Wednesday, after Governor Mitt Romney conceded the election, President Obama took the stage at Chicago's McCormick Place to accept a second term in office and credit his supporters for the victory.
I want to thank every American who participated in this election. Whether you voted for the very first time or waited in line for a very long time. By the way, we have to fix that. Whether you pounded the pavement or picked up the phone, whether you held an Obama sign or a Romney sign, you made your voice heard, and you made a difference.
Thousands of people of all ages and races packed into the center's ballroom to hear the president's speech, which included several promises for the next 4 years.
I am looking forward to reaching out and working with leaders of both parties to meet the challenges we can only solve together. Reducing our deficit, reforming our tax code, fixing our immigration system, freeing ourselves from foreign oil. We've got more work to do.
He also made a passing reference to tackling climate change, saying children deserve to live without the, quote, destructive power of a warming planet. Though voter confusion and irregularities in key swing states had supporters worried the race could drag out for days, the major networks declared President Obama the likely winner fairly early in the evening, and the crowd at McCormick Place erupted in cheers.
Woo! Yes. I'm so excited! Hallelujah. I worked the polls. Yes. We were there at 1 o'clock yes. at night every night for GOTV. It was awesome. Yes. I am so glad I did it. That's awesome. I'm so excited.
That's Chicago native Rainey Kilpatrick, who earned a ticket to the event by volunteering for the president's re-election campaign. She hugged her friend and co-volunteer Joanne Warren as state after state turned blue on the giant screen hanging from the convention center ceiling. Many credit President Obama's decisive victory to the diversity of his supporters, which included the majority of the country's youth, women, and people of color. In particular, the president won an even greater share of the Latino vote than in 2008, enough to decide the popular vote. Latino voters were especially pivotal in Colorado, Florida, New Mexico, and Nevada, where unions and civil rights groups worked to boost Latino turnout and educate voters about the anti-immigrant provisions in the Republican platform. Late last night at McCormick Place, Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa told FSRN the election outcome should send a strong message to the Republican Party.
The Republicans are going to have to do some soul searching. You can't go so far to the right on social issues, on economic issues. You can't take such a extreme position on immigration reform and expect that you're not going to lose women, Latinos, young people. The fact is, that kind of extremism isn't what America's looking for.
The House, Senate, and White House are under the same party control as before. But Villaraigosa said Republicans will be more likely to partner on immigration reform now, knowing that continued opposition could cost them future elections. Outside the center, hundreds of activists with the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights held a march and vigil celebrating the power of the Latino vote in this election and calling on the president to deliver on his promises. Coordinated with protests in Boston and Washington, D.C., the group said the president's first order of business should be comprehensive immigration reform, and they won't accept delays or excuses. Alice Olsen, FSRN, Chicago.
Governor Mitt Romney returns to life as a private citizen today. Romney conceded defeat in his home state of Massachusetts late last night, ending the bitter and hard-fought 2012 presidential election. As many had predicted, the election went to the winner of the key battleground state of Ohio, which Romney lost despite a flurry of visits over the final days of the campaign. The former Massachusetts governor won 206 electoral votes, short of the 270 needed to secure victory, while receiving 48% of the popular vote. In a short concession speech, Romney congratulated President Obama, thanked his supporters, and called for bipartisanship.
The nation, as you know, is at a critical point. At a time like this, we can't risk partisan bickering and political posturing. Our leaders have to reach across the aisle to do the people's work. And we citizens also have to rise to the occasion.
Also in Massachusetts, voters gave Democrats wins in two key congressional races and decided on ballot initiatives dealing with medical marijuana and physician-assisted suicide. FSRN's Jessel Knorr has more from Boston.
Massachusetts voters helped assure Democratic control of the Senate last night, sending consumer advocate Elizabeth Warren to an upset victory over incumbent Republican Senator Scott Brown. The campaign was one of the most closely watched and most expensive of the 2012 election cycle. The two candidates spent more than $65 million on the race. Warren addressed the hundreds of joyous, mostly young supporters that gathered at Plaza Hotel in Boston's Copley Square after she was declared the winner.
Campaign that broke records, raising more money from small donors than any Senate campaign in the history of this country. And knocking on more doors than any Senate race in Massachusetts. An amazing campaign. And let me be clear, I didn't build that. You built that.
Among those in attendance was 23-year-old campaign volunteer David Braid. He said Warren, a key architect of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, would stand up for the middle class.
On big business, man, she's just really going to really crack down, you know, because a lot of what they're doing is really unfair. And, you know, she's, like I said, she's going to be that voice for the little man.
Massachusetts voters also approved a measure to legalize marijuana for medical purposes. Starting next year, with their doctor's approval, patients with serious medical conditions will be able to purchase pot for medical use from state-run dispensaries. 35-year-old Dan DeHari voted in favor of the measure.
I think people who are hurting should find whatever respite they can. And if that helps them a little bit more, that's great. You know, it's not hurting me.
Meanwhile, supporters of another ballot measure that would have legalized physician-assisted suicide for the terminally ill conceded defeat early Wednesday morning. Dahari says he voted against the measure, even though he supports the right to die.
I don't believe that someone dying should be able to do that, make that decision without a second, third opinion, without consulting a psychiatrist, without informing your family.
In the closely fought race for the state's 6th congressional district, Democratic Representative John Tierney claimed victory after contending with controversy surrounding his wife's involvement in an offshore illegal gambling ring. His challenger, Richard Tesai, would have become the first openly gay Republican elected to the U.S. House. Tesai, who lost by under 4,000 votes, refused to concede the race election night. Jessel Noor, FSRN, Boston.
While President Obama secured a second term in office, he will still face a deeply divided Congress. Democrats retained a narrow majority in the Senate, and Republicans will continue their hold in the House. One result that helped the Republicans keep the House was Vice Presidential hopeful Paul Ryan's re-election in Wisconsin. He was joined by Wisconsin Republican Sean Duffy's re-election win in the 7th District. Democrats had hoped to win Duffy's seat. Wisconsin voters also elected the first openly gay senator in U.S. history. Tammy Baldwin, a Democratic congresswoman from Madison, won 51% of the vote, defeating one of the most popular Republican politicians in Wisconsin history. FSRN's Molly Stentz has more from Madison.
Wisconsin's Electoral College votes went for President Obama on Tuesday, continuing the trend of voting Democratic in the country's biggest race, as it has since 1988. But for many in Wisconsin, it was Tammy Baldwin's night. She addressed a large and ecstatic crowd of supporters in Madison Tuesday night.
Now, I am well aware that I will have the honor to be Wisconsin's first woman U.S. Senator. And I am well aware that I will be the first openly gay member. But I didn't run to make history. I ran to make a difference.
Replacing Tammy Baldwin in Congress will be another openly gay politician, Mark Pocan. Pocan is a state representative from Madison, and he handily defeated his challenger in the largely Democratic district. Pocan was one of the leaders of the state assembly during the uprising last year, when tens of thousands protested Republican efforts to cut union rights and the state budget. Pocan said he's ready to take his fight to the House, where he will also be in the Democratic minority.
Well, I was told that you can't get any worse than the current Congress. It's one of dysfunctional as you can get. So I'm going to, you know, try to reach out to people on the other side of the aisle when we can find compromise, but I'm not going to compromise my values. We just have to be able to get things done. At the end of the day, that's the one thing that people expect from us. They haven't done a good job of that this current Congress, and I'm going to try to see if we can't do a little better in the next Congress. You know, this district has a long reputation of a strong, fighting, progressive spirit. I'm up for that, and I'm going to make sure that I do my best to represent our district in Congress, and I'll be ready on day one.
While Wisconsin Democrats won votes for the president and held on to the few congressional seats they had, they lost big in local races. Republicans took back control of the state Senate that Democrats had won through last summer's historic recall elections. This means that despite the big top-of-the-ticket win for Democrats, Wisconsin has a GOP-controlled Assembly, Senate, and Governor. Molly Stentz, FSRN, Madison.
In 4 states, voters approved measures supporting marriage equality and LGBT rights. In Minnesota, an anti-gay marriage amendment was defeated by about 53% of the vote. Washington and Maryland residents approved measures upholding same-sex marriage laws. And Maine made history by approving marriage equality through a popular vote. From WERU in East Orland, Maine, Amy Brown reports.
Lawmakers in Maine passed a same-sex marriage proposal in 2009, but it was repealed by referendum before going into effect. Equality advocates then spent the next 3 years trying to educate voters about the issue. David Farmer of Mainers United for Marriage says it's a historic win for the state and shows that persistence pays off.
The
through a lot of one-on-one conversations, a lot of hard work, and people willing to open their hearts and their minds and reconsider the issue, today we have a much different result. I think what this demonstrates is that people can change their minds, and the arc of public opinion on the issue of allowing same-sex couples to marry is moving toward that.
Maine voters approved same-sex marriage by about 53% of the vote, roughly the same number that voted to repeal same-sex marriage legislation 3 years ago. As Norm Bamford and his partner Brad Nadeau watched the election returns at a party in tiny Millbridge, Maine, they reflected on what the right to marry will mean to their family.
It's amazing, and we're all just so excited. What it means for me in the relationship, and this is, I mean, Brad and I, we've been on this right from the start, and we've done parades, we've done call banks, we've really been pushing this. And what this means for me personally, and I'm going to try not to cry, but for me personally, it means that Brad will have all the rights of a step-parent that he deserves to have, because I have kids that we're bringing into the relationship. And for him to be able to have the right to for medical treatment for my children and, you know, and just be a stepdad in the real sense of the word is really what means the most to me.
Nadeau had a medical scare earlier this year and realized that he was lucky that the ER that he went to was one that respected his partner's status.
But some hospitals in Maine, I found out, don't. And they wouldn't even let you pass the door, so... And then also, of course, with the health insurance. And so he was able to come into the room and with me and be there, and because it was really scary.
Proponents of same-sex marriage raised an estimated $5 million for the campaign, according to maplight.org. The National Organization for Marriage was the leading funder behind the No campaign, contributing more than $1 million. A spokesperson for the group issued a statement Wednesday morning saying that they are extremely disappointed. Same-sex couples will be able to apply for marriage licenses in Maine within 60 days. Amy Brown, Free Speech Radio News, East Orland, Maine.
Maryland joins Maine in breaking the pattern of same-sex marriage initiatives losing at the ballot box. Until yesterday, they had failed in 30 states. Voters in Maryland legalized same-sex marriage with a narrow 52% win. They also passed another groundbreaking measure allowing undocumented students access to in-state college tuition. FSRN's Clayton Kahn has more.
Undocumented immigrant youth, their families, and supporters filled Arcos Restaurant in East Baltimore to celebrate a victory for immigrant rights. 58% of Maryland voters approved ballot measure number 4, Maryland's DREAM Act, that will grant undocumented immigrant students in-state college tuition. Maryland voters were able to set a precedent by being the first state to approve the DREAM Act through popular vote. For 43-year-old ESL teacher and supporter Kathleen Callahan, news of the results gave her a strong sense of pride. She says the tireless work of her students exemplifies democracy in action.
The idea that I can go into school tomorrow, tell my students that it worked, all their work worked.
And put
that's
it on the
awesome.
Table and
bring
them to the table to negotiate.
Because they work with you. And that's like, you know, that's what we teach them to do. That's what democracy is supposed to be.
A coalition of supporting organizations, including faith-based and student groups, unions, and civil rights advocates, also mobilized strong efforts to get the vote out. These supporters raised about $1.3 million to back their efforts. The immigrant advocacy group Casa de Maryland was one of the most vocal of these organizations. Shola Jai, a 28-year-old Nigerian immigrant, is a member of Casa. He says passage of the DREAM Act will help shift the overall debate over immigration policy.
Over the last 2 years, we saw a lot of anti-immigrant legislation come out of other states, and I think this is really going to turn the tide. And as a country and a state, we're saying that we want laws that really benefit society and that don't limit anybody and that really value the contributions that every American has to make, whether you came here as an immigrant, whether you were born here.
The law will grant eligible undocumented youth, known as DREAMers, college tuition rates that are about 3.5 times less than what they would have had to pay. For 17-year-old DREAMer Natalie Uribe from Chile, approval of this measure is bittersweet. She says that more hurdles need to be overcome to truly give immigrant families opportunities to be successful.
You know, even with this in-state tuition, we're still at a catch-22 where we want to become full citizens of the country that we call home, but we're faced with this 10-year ban if we want to do that. So we need a pathway. We need to create some way for these students to become the citizens that they ought to be, that they're deserving of.
Many DREAM Act supporters celebrating Maryland's victory agree with Uribe's sentiment and are vowing to put their efforts towards broader immigration reform. Clayton Kahn, FSRN, Baltimore.
In Colorado, Democrats kept the state Senate and regained the state House, an outcome important to supporters of civil unions. An amendment to the state's constitution asking Colorado politicians to introduce and support campaign finance reform also passed. But perhaps the biggest news from this state was the passage of a law changing the state's constitution to legalize marijuana for adults. FSRN's Jim Poland brings us more.
Opponents of Colorado's Amendment 64, which changes the state's constitution to allow adults to grow and use small amounts of marijuana, said that the drug was unsafe and would cast Colorado in a negative light. Thornton voter Connie, who preferred not to give her last name, said she was casting her vote against the amendment.
I just think it encourages kids, it makes them think it's safe, and then they'll just start using earlier.
But proponents contested that using pot was not harmful, and the promise of adding tens of millions of tax dollars to help build schools and over $100 million overall to the state's coffers was also appealing. Teresa Mueller, also from Thornton, voted for legalization.
I do think there's a lot of good that can come from it for our economy. I mean, a lot of people say, you know, it could become the Amsterdam of the United States, but Amsterdam makes a lot of money, so not a bad thing.
The yes votes carried handily. About 55% of voters said that regulating marijuana like alcohol was right for the state. The news was greeted enthusiastically at the campaign party in Denver. Campaign co-director Brian Vicente was among the revelers, and he echoed the themes of the campaign.
We're going to produce a ton of tax revenue for the state. There's going to be new jobs. We're going to redirect law enforcement resources towards more serious crime, and Colorado can lead the nation.
Voters in Washington state also passed marijuana legalization Tuesday. Proponents say victories in these two western states widens the discussion and search for solutions to the nation's costly and ineffective drug wars. Vicente is proud that Coloradans are leading the way.
Coloradans are common sense people. They understand that marijuana prohibition has failed. The war on drugs has been a horrible policy disaster. Coloradans have decided to try a new path forward.
The state's constitution will be amended when the governor, Democrat John Hickenlooper, signs the amendment. Although he was an opponent of Amendment 64, he said that he will follow the will of the people. With assistance from Bennett Berkland and Rocky Mountain Community Radio, this is Jim Pullen, FSRN, Boulder.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Janine Etter and Shauna Ray. Our theme music was composed and produced for FSRN by Alan Weatherhead. For our complete election 2012 coverage, including interviews and on-the-ground reports, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/FSRN. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.
Welcome to Kaput Radio. I'm Martin, and you may remember last episode I tried to make the case for the link of necessary profits and market dominance. We need the wars, profitable wars, and they are profitable. This time, I focus on the old folly of economic levers which certainly don't work and cause unnecessary pain and suffering. Austerity, a kind of obscured war on our own people. Don't contract it.
First, there was the collapse of civilization. Anarchy. Genocide. Starvation. And then we heard the rumors that the last scientists were working on a cure and restore the world. Restore it? Why? I like the death.
I like the misery. I like this world!
And today's economic news was not good. Last night was a 6% fall on the Athens Exchange because their bank fell about 16%. After the finance ministry there said the banks would not be able to swap their worthless Greek bonds for new ones issued by the European Stability Mechanism, which was a bit of a spanakopita in the works. And that's finance.
In the Greek midwinter, crises may have shown Dickens of a splinter for the Eurozone. Sovereign debt so huge is dim and grim to trim when it's met by Scrooges.
Economic plight as Spain's unemployment reaches record highs and Greece is failing on its deficit reduction obligations.
It's a catastrophe about to happen. All that the EU and the European Central Bank have done since 1 year ago is simply to buy time with cosmetic measures. But the core problem, I maintain, is not a sovereign debt problem, not the sovereign debt of Greece nor of Italy or other countries. The core problem has been from the beginning and remains a banking system, the major international banks in Europe that are de facto insolvent and being held afloat on life support from the ECB. So the bailout measures toward Greece have not done anything to help the Greek economy or stabilize Greece. They've gone to bail out the banks in France and elsewhere in the EU that are technically in insolvency because of their exposure. The austerity that's being demanded by EU governments like Germany is having the effect, and the irony is this is what Bruning did in 1931 that paved the way for the Third Reich because of the unemployment across Germany. So austerity is never a long-term solution to a crisis of this scale. So I don't think anybody really making the crucial decisions has an historical perspective of what happened in the last 70, 80 years back during the 1930s in Europe.
William Engdahl, author of Gods of Money.
Thank you.
Speak of care cut. Who will speak?
Climate, nations, all were in upheaval. The earth transformed into a poisonous, scorched desert known as the Cursed Earth. Millions of people crowded into a few megacities where roving bands of street savages created violence the justice system could not control. Law as we know it collapsed. From the decay rose a new order, a society ruled by a new elite force, a force with the power to dispense both justice and punishment. They were the police, jury, and executioner all in one.
Hello, Germany and Europe. My name is Mr. Panos. And this is a message from the Hellenic people around the world. Fuck you, Malacca!
Genius. Genius, genius, genius.
What's happening to the Greek economy? Why is it in shambles? I'll tell you why. Because we've been playing a trick on you. We're lazy? No, we're resting.
Sure, we worked for the Turks for 400 years. We're on vacation.
The so-called crisis in Greece is the happiest day of my life when I heard that Germany was going to send another bailout. Bailout. Thank you for your money, Germany. We have been waiting a long time for war reparations from World War II. The Chancellor of Germany is Angela Merkel. She's a woman. So you're going to give me a loan? This is the first time a woman gives a man some money. What happens? The Chancellor, she comes home from work and her husband makes a schnitzel sandwich in his apron? Everyone had the motivation to join the European Union in the first place. The reason Greece joined the European Union is because we saw to the future. We know the German mind. You can't change the German. How come a mouse goes like this? Looking for chill. Because he's a mouse. How come a German is trying to take over the world? Because he's a German. Nobody says how come Germany is so interested in the European Union to expand.
so we knew eventually he was going to come to try to take the world over again. We built the trap. The Trojan horse is the mainland. We say, come and bring your money here. Never trust a Greek who's broke. He has money in the basement, hidden in the mattresses, all drachmas. There's two economies in Greece. One with the euro for the German tourists, and one that Greek people use with each other, drachmas. Thank you, Germany. You fell right into the plot. We use the euro to bet you. The genius, genius Greek people. Greece has a problem? No, you gave Greece the money. You have a problem. So we pretend to use the euro. When the Germans come for vacation, we say, hello, Hans. Hello, Mr. Schnitzelfest. Come sit down here at the table. Look, the nice volcano in Santorini. Can I get you a drink? Come bring your son. Oh, look at the pale monkey running on the beach with his little penis flapping around. Sure, everyone's naked. This is the family values you have. The mother's titties are flopped out like a sheep's titties. The boy can run around with his freckled penis. Everyone's walking around naked in Greece. So the son is looking the mother's tits. Hello, ma'am. Hello, sir. We both speak English here. Thank you for coming to the Greek island of Crete for your vacation, Mr. Hansen Schnitzel. What would you like to eat? A pasticcio? Sir, one moment. Hello, Dimitri. Bring the pasticcio, the German one. Let me go get it for you, Mr. Hansen Schnitzel. This is a plot that the Greeks have had for 60 years to fight the Germans and the Chinese allies. What's really happening here? What's really happening when the German people say we're going to give you a loan? What's really happening? This is the same thing that happened in World War II. What do you mean, Pono? The German people came to Greece while they were trying to conquer the world. You remember this? You have a short memory. Who doesn't have a short memory? Hey, Greek people, we remember when the Chinese people, they used to call themselves Japanese, and the German people tried to take over the world, and they came to Greece to try to get a strategic position on the Greek people. And what happened? We fight and save the world in the Battle of Crete. How we did this? We fight them, they delay to go to Russia, and then they freeze in the snow like morons. Did you remember Schnitzelfest? And this is why Winston Churchill says that the Greeks don't fight like heroes. Heroes fight like Greeks. Because we saved the world from the German Nazi snow monkey Schnitzelfest. This is the second attempt for the German people to come back and try to destroy the Greek culture. Yeah, well, we're going to fight with this time, baby. The superior Greek brain that's fed with feta cheese and olive oil. It's not going to happen, baby. Not on my watch. So what do? We plan reverse psychology. We use reverse psychology with the genius Greek brain. And we say, okay, we want to be part of the European Union. This is the greatest invention of unity. Sure, German people, we're going to be a part of this union. Genius. Everybody's saying Greece is going to crumble the European Union. The European Union is a threat. No, we're going to save Europe from the German Empire trying to rise again. Genius, genius. How are we going to do that? Bankrupt them. Hello, Blondie. Thank you for your payment for civilization. Rest of the world, from Greece, you're welcome.
That's the bratwurst. Bring that hiney on over here while you're at it, baby. We got a lot of Greeks trying to steal our cash. Never really had luck, couldn't afford that crash. Get a job. Get a job. You're on a holiday that can't last forever. Now you're in a corner scraping euros together. Get a job. Get a job.
halt jetzt endlich mal die Klappe.
Thanks for your time tonight.
Well, good evening. It's very kind of you to invite me in.
You're an economist, aren't you?
I am, yes. As a matter of interest, was it the handshake? It's a bit of a giveaway.
No. I was reading your research data here.
Oh, big pardon.
Economic history, isn't it?
Economic history, yeah. Yes. I'm an economic historian. Good evening.
Good. Big field, economic history.
It is a big field, yes. It depends on how you define it, of course.
And how do you define it?
Well, it depends on how you define define.
Of course. Now, can you tell us what's happening to the EU? It's at a kind of crisis point, isn't it?
Well, yes. At the moment, I don't think there's any doubt about it. They're going through a particularly difficult period. Mm.
This is a real test of the actual whole concept of the European Union.
It is, and particularly the events perhaps of this week.
Because the European economies are linked.
They are linked, yes. That's the idea.
The governments are linked too.
The governments are linked, yes. There's a European Parliament.
Yes. What does the European Parliament do?
What does it do?
Yeah.
Well, nobody knows what it actually does.
Well, where does it meet?
Well, they have meetings to arrange where they'll meet.
Oh, so there's a choice.
Well, yes. Have you ever been to Europe?
Of course.
Well, there's a lot of countries there. I mean, this is part of their problem. They're trying to unify the joint. But they can currently meet in Belgium or in France or in Luxembourg. They can meet anywhere.
Oh, yeah. So its whole purpose is to come to some agreement about where they're going to meet.
The Parliament?
Yeah.
I don't think that's their entire purpose, but it's certainly an ancillary benefit. Yes.
Sure. Okay. Well, take us back. Where did all this start?
Well, after the Hanseatic League was formed, Hanseatic League?
Yeah.
When?
Yeah.
1360, somewhere there?
What, 14th century?
Yeah.
Well, I think we better start a little bit later. We don't have a lot of time.
Skip the Hanseatic League.
Yeah, I think, if you don't mind.
That's a shame.
Yeah.
It's a similar concept, though. They're trying to unify a large number of countries into what is effectively one market.
So rather than compete with each other,
rather than competing with one another. Yes, indeed. Yeah. They favour one another.
Yeah,
indeed.
And standardise the currency.
Standardise the currency, yes.
So what went wrong?
Well, in this case, some countries other than Germany found out about it.
What are we seeing now, though?
Well, as you know, in economics, the great battle in the 20th century was that between capital and labour.
Won by capital, of
won
course.
Won resoundingly by capital, who then move on to the next round.
And who do they meet in the next round?
And they're going to meet democracy in the final.
Wow, that'll be a good match.
It'll be an absolute cracker.
Democracy.
Oh, yeah, you won't be able to get a ticket.
Where is it?
Where is it?
Yeah.
Well, they're meeting to decide that.
Well, when will they be doing that?
Having a meeting about that as well. There's a meeting about when that meeting will be sometime next week.
Terrific.
I believe there's a meeting about when that is.
Sure. Okay, thank you very much for your time.
I've got to go to a meeting about that.
Big Dave and Little Willie went to the mainland for an important conference with 26 other engines from different companies. I know Sodor's only a little offshore island, said Big Dave, but it's really important that we stand up for what's right for us. I agree, said Little Willie. We can't let the other engines push us around just because they're bigger than us. Before the conference started, Big Dave had a meeting with Eva, a big fat German engine, and Napoleon, a poor little French engine. Look, said Dave, I know you'd like everyone to be part of one big company, but we're just a small island, so why should we join in? Napoleon shrugged his shoulders. It's always the same with you, he said. Always you want to be the special case. It just will not do. And he snorted and stuck his hand inside his jacket. Then Eva said, it is important that we have the level playing field so that the companies all charge the same. We can only do this if I set the fares for you. Dave looked worried. But won't that mean we're all just working for you, he said. Napoleon looked exasperated. We cannot allow you to be different, he huffed. This is unacceptable. And Eva said, do not worry, Napoleon. We have ways of making some toes align. So Dave and Willie went off to meet the other engines, but they'd all sided with Eva and Napoleon. Oh no, said Willie. Looks like we're the only ones who don't want to join the new company. We're going to be shunted into the sidings. Never mind, said Dave. It's not the first time they've tried to take us over, and it won't be the last. But we're still here, aren't we? Anyway, said Willie, the people on Sodor will understand. I'm sure they'll be right behind us. But when Dave got home, the twat controller was not pleased. I don't understand, said Dave. Why are you so upset with what I've done? The twat controller wasn't interested in listening to Dave's explanations at all. You bastard, he said. You've fucked up my chances of a nice cushy job in the new company. And off he stormed, waving his arms in the air in anger. Dave and Little Willie looked at each other in confusion. I think we might have upset him, said Willie. But Dave just smiled. The bloke's a cunt, he said.
The most troubled Spanish banks holding bad real estate debt are getting a multi-billion dollar bailout from Europe. And many people who still have jobs have seen their salaries frozen or cut. Since the crisis started 4 years ago, some 23,000 businesses have filed for bankruptcy.
Mario Monti turns violent on the streets of Riva del Garda in northern Italy. Seeking an end to austerity measures, unionists, members of left-wing political parties and students rally on what's been dubbed No Monti Day. Protesters demanding more jobs and increased investment in education and healthcare.
In protest at austerity measures, the protesters say tax hikes and spending cuts mean workers are being forced to pay debts that rightly belong to the banks and the private sector.
Most working people now are feeling the actions that the government are taking against them. They feel it's a direct attack, and today is all about showing our protest against them.
There are people out there that are the most vulnerable of all that have been attacked by the government.
People are genuinely suffering, but that doesn't seem to count for anything.
We're now distributing food to our people, not because they're on a job seeker's allowance, but because they're on low wages. And because of the cutback, we have to distribute food to these people that's working and can't put food on the table.
We've decided to block the road to try and draw attention to the fact that the cuts are having a really detrimental effect on disabled people in this country. People are being found fit for work and they're dead within the week. And it keeps happening again and again.
The private sector are not paying their taxes and there's figures of £120 billion unclaimed tax. And why are we not going after them?
The Starbucks pay no tax, millionaires get tax cuts, whilst we have people having their welfare cut and their jobs cut. And we want the government to take notice of what everybody is doing today. But if they don't, in my speech later on, I'm going to call for there to be strike action sooner rather than later.
Children learning from a young age that life is about surviving, not thriving. Gang leaders as role models, drug dealers as careers advisors. So today I want to tell you about our approach to crime and justice and the bold and unprecedented action that we're taking, which is Hoodie. Although I never actually said it, and as you've noticed, I haven't said it again today. I'm a politician who's argued frequently for tough punishment. Be tough. Now, we need to be tough. Committing a crime is always a choice. That's why the primary, proper response to crime is not explanations or excuses. It is punishment, meaningful punishment, long prison sentence. Punishment, to treat criminals as victims, to say they had no choice, that would be to treat them like children. But you'll also meet young people who can't read, teenagers addicted to drugs, so they can become part of the solution. It is common sense.
Difficult as it was for me, I have come to an inescapable and profoundly disturbing conclusion. I believe that an elite group of people and the corporations they run have gained control over not just our energy, food supply, education, and healthcare, but over virtually every aspect of our lives. And they do it by controlling the world of finance. Not by creating more value, but by actually controlling the source of money.
It's an old trick to couch a painful reality inside of a flowery platitude. We hear it all the time in our daily lives, and for the most part, we know how to read between the lines when someone tries to do it to us. When a salesman tells you that a used car is a fixer-upper, you know that you're looking at a lemon. Similarly, when the IMF tells a nation that they need to implement austerity in order to get themselves out of a financial crisis, here, too, lies a gaping chasm between the language and the reality. Austerity is one of those Orwellian terms that has been injected into our political discourse precisely because it is a nice-sounding word for a very painful reality. Austerity implies discipline, self-restraint, even nobility. Austerity is prudent. Austerity is modest. Austerity is a virtue. It is an end in itself. If the IMF or the European Central Bank come to the people of the collapsing European nation and tell them to sacrifice their pensions and their savings and their very standard of living, all for a debt that their government has fraudulently racked up in their name, no one would go for it, and rightly so. But tell those same people that they need to implement austerity measures in order to get back on their feet economically, and many will be willing to live in the harshest of conditions, content to put up with the dismantling of their nation itself, in the vain hope that by giving more power to the international financial institutions, they can somehow avoid economic collapse. The trick, of course, is that reality is completely the opposite. Like the doctor giving you false assurances that this will only hurt a bit, the economic amputation that the bankers have in store for the once proud nations of the industrialized world will be excruciating. Just ask anyone in the third world. They should know. They've been going through these austerity plans for decades. This is the real face of austerity. People are taking to the streets to protest the measures that are about to be taken in the name of paying back to the banksters what corrupt governments stole from the people. On the other side stand the police, increasingly militarized and deployed in the service of the banksters and the politicians. The battle lines are forming.
Portugal, Ireland, Greece, and Spain. Who's gonna pay for my house?
Greece's sovereign debt crisis brought the government to the brink of collapse. The public fury over savage austerity measures erupted in pitched battles with police on the streets of Athens.
There's much to blame for this crisis. Deregulation, speculation, the mortgage scams that started in the late 90s. When European nations said, let's get together. Big deal countries, big deal currencies, the Netherlands. France and Germany, you want everybody in that club. Greece's only got it because of a government's flood. But when he is out here, well, it's just one catch. With these are all making the value. Cash evaluation, household and recession. It's easy if a poor and a buyer good. When markets crash in the Eurozone, speculators say Greece can't pay the loans. If they use the euro, they can't afford this mess by putting more money to refinance it. Portugal, Ireland, Greece, and Spain. Who's gonna bail them out? Don't take that money, let's just save that money.
Last year's rescue, and it's hoping to ask the Eurozone for more funds.
In the 90s, low interest and inflation made them look so strong. On the need to grow and the ease to spend, it was the fact that it went back by foreign funds. Three nations have been given bailout checks, Greece, Ireland, Portugal, because we're in there. Money never comes with downstreams attached, austerity measures designed to save cash. Greece spent too much, couldn't win the debt, cut payments to debt with the Goldman Sachs. Austerity measures were very stern, strikes to new rise, cover next is the burn. She's not about the bailout, it's the debt of the mouth. At the end of the day, it's all about child. Unemployment is something over 20%. What's a billion-dollar bill when you can't pay your rent? Portugal, Ireland, Greece, and Spain. Who's gonna bail them out? Don't take that money, let's just save that money.
Inescapable and profoundly disturbing conclusion. I believe that an elite group of people and the corporations they run have gained control over not just our energy, food supply, education, and healthcare, but over virtually every aspect of our lives. And they do it by controlling the world of finance, not by creating more value, but by actually controlling the source of money.
We have a private bank that prints money on behalf of the Treasury. The Federal Reserve prints money on a debt-based system, which creates scarcity. But it puts a group of insiders in a position of having access to all the data about the economy when we don't. So you have a small group of bankers who understand the data on how the money works in the economy, and it gives them the ability to print money in a way that the insiders are protected and everybody else is drained.
One of the earliest examples of corporate fascism can be found in the current U.S. banking system. This system, known as the Federal Reserve System, or Fed, is a quasi-private, government-sanctioned banking cartel, little different from OPEC or any other cartel. Just as OPEC dictates the amount and price of oil, the Federal Reserve dictates the amount and price of money.
Responding to volatility in the global economy, and when our country was threatened, we saved it.
Officers positioned Grant face first on the floor with one officer near his head, a second near his back, and a third officer standing nearby. There appeared to be a brief struggle. Then, a two-year veteran BART officer stands, draws his weapon, and fires.
Freedom is slavery, and slavery is freedom. The terrible tragedies of modern Western economic systems have occurred not in spite of, but because of, past economic freedoms. The massive increases in Western wealth throughout the 19th century resulted from economic freedoms. We danced around the endless violence of our dying system, but we can only be kept in the cages we refuse to see. Wake up.
Thanks for listening, folks. As always, the sources can be viewed at radioforall.net. I'm Martin, and until next time, catch you soon!
If you'd like a free track from my new live comedy album, Pepper Spray the Tears Away, just send an email to pepperspraythetearsaway@gmail.com. And now, here's your moment of clarity. There are two things America has in spades: religious people and greedy people. All right, we have other things in spades too, such as pride and ignorance and people with an ass in the front. But we'll leave that for another time. Over 80% of Americans claim to be religious, and a high percentage of those are greedy assholes. Now, I don't believe the Bible is anything more than mildly fascinating stories with an occasional woman getting stoned to death for giving out pussy at the wrong time. But if you're gonna say you're living your life by the Bible, then you have to actually do it. You have to go all out. For example, it is easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God. That's Luke 18:25. I'm not that good with geometry, but I would say that almost means rich people can't get into heaven. Because first of all, camels are much larger than a needle unless you've got one of those adorable teacup camels, but they're expensive. And secondly, camels rarely sew anything, so the odds of them even encountering a needle are rather slim. Matthew 6:19, do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy, where thieves break in and steal. Store up for yourselves treasures in heaven where moth and rust do not destroy and where thieves do not break in. That's right. Fucking moths. They'll get you every time. Anybody dumb enough to become a billionaire has not stopped to consider the moth. Luke 18:22. Sell everything you have and give to the poor. You will have treasure in heaven. The Bible, the book you claim is written by the Lord, tells you to sell everything and give to the poor. It doesn't say give $5 to the dude on the street who's drumming on an old bucket and then keep the rest of your millions for cars and swimming pools and blood diamonds, dancing horses and prancing masseuses. Make it a carnival of ass holiness. Or how about Luke 3:11? Whoever has two coats must share with anyone who has none, and whoever has food must do likewise. Coats? Whoever has two coats? I'm pretty sure Mitt Romney has more than two coats. Fuck! factories. This is your book, folks. And it says don't let anyone go cold. Don't let anyone go hungry. Don't throw families onto the streets to enrich yourself. It probably says something about not eating foie gras, too. But we'll deal with that another time. Proverbs 31:8. Speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves, for the rights of all who are destitute. Not only are you supposed to allow for freedom of speech rather than shooting it with a rubber bullet, you're supposed to speak for the destitute. I would be surprised if Jamie Dimon has ever spoken to the destitute, even just to curse him out. He probably pays someone to do that for him. Now listen, rich people, weep and wail because of the misery that is coming upon you. Your wealth has rotted and moths have eaten your clothes. Your gold and silver are corroded. Their corrosion will testify against you and eat your flesh like fire. You have hoarded wealth in the last days. The wages you failed to pay the workmen who mowed your fields are crying out against you. You have lived on earth in luxury and self-indulgence. You have fattened yourselves in the day of slaughter. You have condemned and murdered innocent men who were not opposing you. James 5:1. I think the point is clear, rich people. If you don't quit treating your fellow man like shit, you will have moths to contend with. And I'm sure there's worse stuff down in eternal damnation, like a few hot pokers up the butt, but it sounds like the moths are pretty prevalent. Look, all I'm trying to say is this is your crazy book of fairy tales. If you choose to believe it, then fucking believe it. I live my life based on a book called The King's Trousers, but I don't just ignore the part about the trousers. And that's what you're doing when you claim the Bible and ignore the poor. That's your Moment of Clarity from LeeCamp.net. If you want to play the audio from Moment of Clarity on your podcast, radio show, webcast, whatever, if you want to play it for free, no problem. Just email LeeCampMail, M-A-I-L, at gmail.com. Thanks. Keep fighting.
Plans, no plans at all. Evil man's always transcending. Fight her like sheep, swallow everything. Always simpletons or pretend.